get a lot of size opportunities for both Jay and next to me is Shabu, who is the secretary, and I'm going to allow yourself an opportunity to introduction.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Monica Newton. I'm DDG Arts, Culture Promotion and Development at the Department of Arts and Culture.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Lula Manda Bankulu from the Department of Arts and Culture.
I'm Joseph Oldan Tlapo-Shope from the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation, and we act as secretary to the Presidential Task Team. Good morning,
ladies and gentlemen, honorable members. Good morning, Chair and honorable members. I am Major General Alfred Khan from the Directorate for the Crime Investigation, commonly known as the Hawks, and I'm the head of commercial crime within the Hawks.
Ngiyabulisa kumalungu abekileyo igama lam ndingusimeon nganono kwi-office kaminister for arts and culture.
Good morning, Chairperson and honorable members of the committee. My name is Mishundri Padiachi. I'm from the Department of Trade and Industry and I'm responsible for intellectual property law and policy.
Good morning, my name is Kosnath Mkhonzo from the Department of Trade and Industry, where I work with intellectual property as well.
Good morning, my name is Matabo Sidat and I'm from the Presidency.
Good morning, my name is Florence Masebe. I'm Special Advisor to the Task Team on Creative Industry.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Mr. Temba Ndima, Acting Director General of the Department of Arts and Culture.
Morning, honorable members. My name is Msawengos Khumalo, Deputy Director, Department of Arts and Culture. Thank you.
Morning, honorable members. My name is Makoto Madala, CFO for Arts and Culture.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Hope Madolo, Director Internal Audit at the Department of Arts and Culture.
Good morning, honorable members. My name is Rofiwa Mudao. I'm the Parliamentary Officer in the Ministry of Arts and Culture.
Good morning. My name is Bayanda Mzoneli. I'm from the Office of the Deputy Minister in the Ministry. Yes, those two. They are in the
other meetings were going to come through to be part of this. So we just extended the apology.
The chair has already moved that we note and accept the apologies. Let everyone speak. Thank you. Colleagues, we've got the agenda in front of us. I was still talking about item number two, which I think we should, because these are issues that we are dealing with almost on a daily, I mean, whenever we're meeting, we like to get updates, but if colleagues agree, we will put them towards the end and allow for item number four to kick in, and then the rest of the other items will follow. We'll make comments as we progress with the rest of the agenda. Are we fine with that arrangement, colleagues? Shifting our program, which we normally do from time to time, to prioritize this matter that we'd like to do. Dr. Rodman, are we fine? Okay. We are therefore starting with item number four. We'll come back to item number two, and then end with item number six. At this point, I don't know whether I should allow the DM to walk us through, but indeed he is in charge of the program, and he will assign whoever he decides to. But I know he's quite an articulate person, so he can handle the whole thing himself. DM, over to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you to the Portfolio Committee for allowing us to give you a briefing in terms of the progress that has been made by the Presidential Task Team on Creative Industries. The task team was appointed by the President subsequent to him having meetings with artists, various artists, who expressed challenges that they were confronted with. The task team was put in place in 2009, and at the time it was chaired by Deputy Minister Mapela, and in 2014 the President appointed me to chair the task team, several other Deputy Ministers. We have done some work, which is what we're going to be taking you through, and I'm going to allow Ms. Josephelda Chapo to take us through the presentation which we have prepared, and then from there we'll take questions and comments. Thank you.
If you say that, anything for you say.
as the Deputy Minister has already said, the first Presidential Task Team was established in 2009, and this task team, the present one, which he chairs, continues to do the work, continues on the work done by the previous task team. And this particular task team, the letter, and we're quoting from the letter of appointment, said it is to champion support to performing artists and musicians on matters including piracy, copyright protection and infringement, local content and affiliate in broadcast media, social welfare and security, income tax awareness, unity and transformation of the industry, as well as skills transfer and development. And those terms of reference informed the membership of the task team. And that is why, for example, chairperson and honorable members and colleagues, you would find that we have someone, not because we've done anything wrong, but they are responsible for such issues. So the meetings happen very, very regularly. And then the task team has embarked on various interventions and consultations to unlock and open, optimize the performance industry. The latest consultation we had was two weeks ago on a Saturday, and we were meeting with actors and other people along the value chain. The secretariat is at the PME, but each department is assigned key deliverables. So the specific terms of reference for the task is so small. It's a coordinating government's response to the concerns of the industry, catalyzing and accelerating the creation of the conducive environment for artists to thrive, to provide a strategic platform for decision makers, governments, civil society, and private sector to discuss collective action, to allow for an interaction between the president, the deputy ministers, and the performing artists and industry to receive and discuss reports on government implementation. So those were the generic terms of reference, and then there were immediate tasks that we identified, which we are always monitoring ourselves against. It's an effective intervention against piracy and intellectual property and copyright infringement, increasing local content, enabling media to foster values and drive social cohesion, extending social welfare and social insurance coverage, including income smoothing for artists, skills development and skills transfer, and general transformation in the industry. So the first thing that happened was that the industry was formalized. Now it's able more or less to speak in one voice, and I'm saying more or less because when you speak to artists, depending who you speak to, they will always claim that because it was not organic, it was enabled by the Department of Arts and Culture and other government departments. There are still challenges with many artists believing that it's not as as it should be, but at least now there's an organized structure on that. And then on intellectual property, the first thing that the task team did was to endorse the recommendations of the Copyright Review Commission, the one that was set up by the Minister of DTI in 2010, and then the report was in 2011, and those are the recommendations. And they include needing to amend legislation to allow for one collective society, that the DTI develops a standard template of terms and conditions for contracts for the music sector, that the administration costs of collective society must be reduced, and the government, through an act, must administer all collective society. So what has happened is that the Copyright Amendment Bill and the Performance Protection Bill was introduced in Parliament in July 2016, and the bills allow for one collecting a society pay a set of rights to all music governed by the Copyright Act, the compensation for commercial reuse of work, enabling that an artist is entitled to royalty when the work is resold. And then the quotas for local content, 80% for public entities and 60% for commercial and private entities. And then vesting the ownership of copyright for whose owner cannot be located or deceased or whatever. So what has happened meanwhile is this is taken through a parliament. Meanwhile, private persons are being encouraged to make use of existing legal protections of the Patent Act, Copyright Act, the Design Act, and so on. And then also the DTI organizes workshops periodically with artists to teach them how to register formal businesses and how to protect their intellectual property, but also a music development strategy was developed. So on piracy in music and audiovisual property, the Directorate of Priority Crime Investigation and Segregation Capacity national and provincial level to prevent, combat, and investigate offences, and it focuses on weakening the business system used to commit this crime. So it's not only just the race, but behind the race, dealing with the big people who push and enable this massive piracy to happen. So there's a difficulty, though, in implementing the act, and those are the difficulties that we identified, that the IP owner must raise the complaint first, and then the police must ascertain from the IP owner whether or not the suspect has requisite authority to trade, and the police must prove that the suspect has prior knowledge that the item in question is a counterfeit good and so on. So, but in spite of all of these difficulties, there were arrests made and 2.3 million worth of pirated CDs and DVDs were seized in 2015-2016. And then awareness campaigns are ongoing and various forums have been established to deal with these crimes. The nice thing about it is that all the people responsible for each of these things that I'm raising are here, so they can go on in detail as much as the members would like to hear. And then on local content, we all celebrated when in May 2016, the ABC took a decision to implement 90% local music across all radio stations. And then that was also agreed that it will be across a general and guarantee that 90% of the wide range of music royalties will remain in South Africa, because as the members, the colleagues know, a bulk of the money was going straight to the Beyonce of the world. Now this forces South African industry to increase a production. It encourages the development of new talent, it encourages job creation across the value chain, and it increases revenue streams for the local music industry, creating more broadcast opportunities for industry music airplay. It helps people improve the vocabulary of all 11 official languages, especially our children who grow up in urban areas and end up speaking only one or two languages, at least now, introduced about all the other official languages. And then the SABC increased royalty payment for music from 3% to 4% on radio for all collecting societies. This too is a big victory. And then agreements have been reached between the broadcaster and collecting society on payment of outstanding legal time. And then the industry engages on the finalization of a new standardized contract for freelance performance. And then work is ongoing around local content, on commercial exploitation fees, and there's also a work on updating the industry agreement for freelance performance. On transforming the film industry, the industrial development, the IDC, provides production supervision and mentoring for filmmakers if needed, and also assists in the distribution and marketing of films. So for the financial year, IDC funded films for with youth and a shareholding of 25%. The task team has identified a lot of weaknesses though with the Black Emerging Filmmakers Transformation Fund, and both the IDC and the NFEF have been tasked to come up with a plan to make this more transformative and more accessible to where it's needed most. And then the National Film and Video Foundation is, I'm sure, I'll say this anyway, but I'm sure members know, it's a agency mandated to develop and promote South African films and to provide opportunities for persons from disadvantaged communities, especially to get involved in the industry and to address historical imbalances. It's the only institution that provides development funding and also funds cultural significant films that have limited commercial value. So currently, they are the project that they have were to mark the 40th anniversary of the Soweto uprising and the 60th anniversary of the Women's March. So the assessment in order to approve funding is divided into three tiers, and then for this financial year, 66 projects are being financed and 38 are in development. So the major challenges is that the IDC needed to be reminded by the task team that the criteria for financing film must also include nation building. It shouldn't just be about how much the film is made or the commercial value, but also it must look at what story is telling in relation to South Africa. and the nation building project that we are all embarking on. And then the task team also identified weaknesses within the Black Imaging Film Transformation Fund. And then on pooling of income, this is, I think, is one of the toughest, most difficult deliverables, largely because of needing to, of the difficulty or in pinning down the relationship between and the employer and the employee and the independent actors, the actors are the independent contractors. How do you ensure that they have some form of social insurance, social security? So what has happened is that there's a sub a working committee made up of all government departments that deal with social welfare and social insurance. And then the committee is reviewing various proposals and modalities to ensure that whatever social insurance package that we come up with is sustainable and it is feasible. Meanwhile, there's a proposal that the desk is set up in the Department of Arts and Culture to provide financial advisory and planning services for artists, and also for the Department of Arts and Culture to improve awareness of existing products in the market, and that the Department of Labor must conduct an investigation of how artists could be included in the USF. They've done that for many other atypical jobs, but also that they increase the frequency of inspections in various workplaces of then there's the white paper review that the task team is monitoring, and again, this is not moving as fast as it should, but it is being reviewed, taking into consideration what has worked, what needs to change in light of the mandate of ensuring that all sectors work towards radical
Any addition that those on my left would like to present? Did you? Are you fine? Baba, what is it called?
Yes, sir.
Are you fine? Okay. Colleagues, the presentation is in front of us. Who wants to be the first taker? Chairperson.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Makondo. Then I'll go to Dr. Fogbo. And then I'll proceed to the remainder of the takers. Mamuzoli, Nele, Aguna, and Nikela, you will have to speak for your constituents. Baba, we follow, and then, yeah, Madam, you'll be the last.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chair. We really appreciate this opportunity of getting this information from the task team. And because as the portfolio committee, we've always believed, I mean, from the first day that we came into this portfolio committee, we've always believed that artists are job creators in nature. They don't go around looking for jobs, but they create jobs for themselves. And we believe that they are the people that have to be supported. We need to support them as much as possible. So it's really, really heartening to see that there is work that is being done. But it really shows that you're not used to presenting to this particular portfolio committee, because we want the detail here. And if you are saying, for instance, that the task team has identified weaknesses and challenges, what are those weaknesses and challenges? You need to point them out. So that, because as the Portfolio Committee on Arts and Culture, what we are saying is that, yes, our constitutional mandate is to oversee, but as this particular Portfolio Committee, we want to support, we want to advise as much as possible, because we realize that it's not about us, it's not about the department, it's not about whoever, but it's about the artist. This is what this is all about. So you need to give us the detail. And if you are saying that this is what you are going to do, when are you going to do it? Because we need to monitor that. Say, you said in June you are going to do this. Have you done it? If not, what are the problems? And how can we assist? Because we believe that we need to take an extra mile than just doing the just discharging the mandate that is constitutional. When you talk about piracy, it really, this is really hurting this industry. In the Eastern Cape, we have an experience of artists going out there to fight for themselves. That's where abandoned. Because police are not doing much to stop this. We have instances where Ulusan went out there to take CDs from the people who are selling them. You know, so I think more effort should be, you know, discharged to ensure that. And what's worse is that they will say that the city will have Lusanda's name. And this old Magogo who loves Lusanda's song so much would buy the CD. When she plays the CD, it's pornography. Can you imagine? So I think a lot of work has to be done around this area because they use the names of our artists to do their dirty business. These people that I don't know who they are. So I think it's important for us to look into that seriously and ensure that we stop these people in their tracks. And the coordination of the work that is being done, I think we are used to working in silos. You'll have your DTI there with a lot of money, your Department of Arts and Culture with little resources that they give NFDF this amount. I think we need to come to the center. I think this has started. We need to strengthen that center so that at the end of the day, artists are able to say, and we need to have time frames for ourselves. Because if we don't do that, we will keep on saying, no, this is ongoing. That's the ninth time that officials lie. It's an ongoing thing, my time, you know. It's ongoing. You can't measure ongoing. We need to hear that this year, this is what we are going to do. This is when we are going to do it. This is how we are going to do it. But I think it's important to note, really, to appreciate the work that is being done. And to see how we can actually all work together, because it's not about us, it's about the artists. And I think it's high time that artists begin to feel, not see, but feel that these issues are being attended to. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. I agree with the Chair that the presentation doesn't assist this portfolio committee. It lacks details. Sitting here, Chair, we can understand really the challenges that the artists are facing with regard to this presentation. It lacks serious details. But however, Chair, we want to understand the task team in relation to how do they coordinate with various departments that can play a role in making sure that we support our artists. A year ago, we met with SAMRO, an organization that deals with realities with regard to music that is played by various organizations. there was a difficulty in some of the departments that are playing music in making sure that they assist in paying royalties. For example, I can give an example of your correctional services. When you visit prisons, you will hear music being played there. So wanted to understand as to how do you coordinate with such department to make sure that they themselves contribute in terms of royalties to this artist. Your different companies, your MTN, your Vodacom, when you call, there will be a song that you will listen before you speak to a consultant. Whether those are taken into consideration, making sure that those who have played, who have created that particular music, their way doesn't go in vain. The other issue, Chair, I'm not so sure with regard to capacity of the Hawks. Most of this piracy happens on the internet. When you Google, you will be told that South Africa is ranked 14th in the world in terms of music piracy. And most of such piracy happens on the internet. What capacity do the Hawks have in order to make sure that we kept such? For now, Chair, let's get a response. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Also thank for the Deputy Minister for the presentation. Some key issues, as my colleague has said, as you know, have been excluded or has not been researched. One other thing is the first one is the collecting agencies. Now I'm not sure as the other pirate collecting agency or the different collecting agencies have been shut down, and what would the costs that these collecting agencies were gathering with respect to how much was given to artists and how much did they get. So did the artists really get what they deserved? Tied to that question, I would like to ask, has the task team identified the turnaround time for the payment of the artists as such? So that I know that the not the National Film and Video Foundation, the other organization mentioned that they'd like to pay the artists quarterly, and but this is not clear within this report. Also, I'd like to ascertain what is the impact of the 90% local music content. First, how has it benefited the artists, and how is the 90% local content monitored? And then lastly, I'd also like to know to what extent has the bursaries, the availability of bursaries increased for filmmaking and for the creative industries in general?
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think I'm covered. I know you want me to speak because you know I always advocate for the payment of royalties for the artists. Let me just wait for the responses, then I'll come in when they respond, when they do respond on the questions, because I have got a lot of questions, but like my colleagues have said, that the report really does not address a lot of questions that we have. Perhaps their response, one will be able to engage.
Okay, thank you, Chair.
Mine is based on the review of the white paper, that it is not actually moving fast enough. I just want to know what is the committee doing to make sure that this actually is being sped up, so that we can actually make sure that the artists are covered on this white paper.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to check the issue of a task team. They did mention that it has been established in 2009. How long are they going to be a task team? Another thing is the issue of paupers. I think most of the artists, when they died, they're just buried like paupers. If the task team is busy looking into it, how far are they? Are they addressing the issue, or there are some challenges even now? Another thing is to check the issue of the task team. Is it operating at the national level, or is it there also in the provincial or regional level? The last one is the issue of the effective intervention that they mentioned on slide number 5. According to your observation as a tax team, are you winning in intervening? Since you're saying you want to intervene, checking on the, is it the copyright and what on slide number 5. Thank you.
I think from me, there are a few things I'd like to raise. The first of them is obviously appreciating the presentation. Colleagues have already punched holes in the report. I will not do that. But to appreciate that post the 52nd and the 53rd conference of the ANC, where the issue of artists were raised as a concerning matter, and government was expected to intervene for the sake of these people who actually were the carriers of our message during the difficult days. And we know that most of the artists, they speak about what happens in the country. As we are having wars, fees must fall currently. We'll hear how artists react to such things. They used to be the carriers of our message to the world about what was happening in South Africa, and unfortunately, when that struggle ended, nobody cared for them. And I think the implementation of that decision, especially at the level of presidency, to me is a very important thing which we must comment. Because this matter has really been placed at the center of government. We are aware that from time to time the task team does brief the president on the progress made. So that is commendable, and I think we would like to, on a continuous basis, engage with your collective this is because towards the end of last year, having had a few interactions with artists, we actually had planned to meet with the departments of trade and industry, with SABC and a host of other bodies to engage on this decision as to when is government moving forward. But yes, when we learned that SAPC has taken a view that 90% of the local content will be guaranteed in the SAP station, we're actually very happy, and I guess we abandoned our mission to converge with those committees, including the departments. And we are aware of the challenges faced at the SAPC, but we hope that that decision will never be reversed, because after the developments started with the then CEO, there were views playing around that the 90% must be whatever. I mean, there were some very interesting, but in a very muted way, messages that were seeking to reverse the thing. So our view is that we obviously will not get into the politics of SABC, but this thing that benefits artists and not SABC team cannot be reversed. It is the right thing to do, and I guess when you drive around in your car, sitting in your house, listening to music, you actually can see the disservice that we have been rendering to our people. When our artists were out there in the world, they had some of the best music in the nation. Still do. But we were not taking care of them in the country. Instead, we're using foreign music in our space, which was very, very bad. But yeah, that decision taken by SABC, it has our unqualified support, and we will fight with the artists that it does not get reversed. And if you meet the artist, I had an opportunity not long ago to meet with artists in Johannesburg. They are the happiest bunch of people about that decision. And they believe that come end of the 12th month and beyond, they will actually see how that benefit trickles down. I think that's one of the issues that my colleagues are raising here. The vesting issue, I don't know what the DAC is dealing with the matter, because I would think while the committee may be wanting to work on that matter, as the minister, as the presenter actually raised it, I think the Department of Arts and Culture should be helping in that regard, because they have a responsibility also to do research. You know, one of the problems in the country is that we've not kept the records of ourselves. We raised this thing when we arrived here, that there's little information about ourselves that we find in the country. But we've got everything else about anyone else who is not an Aboriginal in South Africa, so to speak, or African, which is very bad. And I think we will have to find, either through research or other creative ways, that question, because then you have monies that cannot be distributed to either the owners or the dependents of those. I think the state must find a way of resolving that matter. Now, this question is a very funny one. I'm hearing this for the first time, that if you find an offender, the state must prove that that person knows. How are you going to prove? What happened to that old law that said the ignorance of the law is no excuse? So we don't have that thing no more. We can't have two laws in the same space that apply differently. And if I pass a right robot, they're not going to ask me whether I know or don't know. I'm supposed to be knowing or not knowing. It's some contradiction. Have our laws changed that now you must prove to the court that I knew? Then we're not going to get anything convicted. It's something that I think needs to be reviewed. If we have such a law, then we must review it. So it weakens our whole system. But unless if, you know, being a constitutional country is a very pricey state to maintain. And yeah, but it's a very funny law. We don't have a lawyer here. Ne? Do we have any lawyer around? Are you a lawyer, Baba Host?
No.
No, I think we need to get this thing, because there must be something wrong. Because once we have laws that are contradictory to each other, and you take those laws to the Constitutional Court, and the last law, which is wrong, which I believe to be wrong, is said to be the latest, there is, as much as they may not have stated it in law, but it can actually override and render, I mean, override the earlier law and rules, and it may actually open us to, and therefore whatever they are trying to do as hawks would be worth nothing. I mean, it's a funny, very funny arrangement. Now, Minister, one of the problems that I have heard from one radio station, just that I can't remember, I've been trying to remember the station, but I think it plays Indian music. Lotus. They actually were complaining that the 90% regime has got undesired consequences for them. It means the music they're playing is not local. The nation that they're doing there is not local. And as to why they can't do it locally, something that I'm unable to answer. But what happens to that station? Not that I advocate for what they are saying or not, but there's that complaint, not that I'm saying it must be entertained, but what is our response to that query? I guess colleagues have already spoken to some of the things, and the issue around advisory services, financial and advisory services. We are saying here the Department of Arts and Culture should take responsibility for that aspect. I don't know. It's a very, not that I say they can't, they won't, they may not have the necessary capacity, but I know that they don't have that capacity as we speak. But that's one area that is a very big danger. I mean, even now, Zipe gave those boys never out of music, but all these, you know, nice places to be in music, arts, sports, and what have you. You have people who, I mean, those guys got quite good money now from Egypt, from their last game. And the likelihood of them just buying Lamborghinis and all those things and don't even insure them is likely to happen. So it's not only artists, but those people, you'll find them in all those areas. For me, this committee, which is a collective, whilst it exists, it has been, would have been the best vehicle to intervene in that space in the interim. And perhaps post its life, leave a regime behind that will continue to help. Because artists last longer than sports people. I mean, about you are old now. They're still there, I think. If they didn't get money, they would have died as paupers. But for the sports people, that's where the highest is. So they make their millions between age 18 to age 32, if you're lucky to go beyond 82. But by 32, you finish your trade, and you also finish your money. So it's a big risk, and I think it's an area that it may not be part of the task team's responsibility, but if you say Department of Sports train them on survival skills, Department of Arts and Culture take care of your... My view is that with the 90% regime, artists may actually not even need any training, because the problem is not that they're not trained, it's just they were not getting anything. They were ripped off by these agents that stood on their way. I think the decision that we need to take is really to make sure that artists get the money. If I get the money, surely I would be very irresponsible not to use it profitably. Now, like, it's a business, so nobody needs to, I mean, they themselves with their organization can really educate themselves, because they have a lifelong life as artists until death do they separate. So for me, the people who are actually at the risk are the sports people. But yeah, the departments have got that responsibility. Now our role is oversight and then they're executing. we wouldn't have a problem. We'd be happy to hear that the department has been tasked to do that work, and we will oversee them for failure to do that work. But for personally, as a person now, I think with this decision is what we needed. And I think that's where we should end, and then I would allow Minister, your team to take the floor. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm going to respond to some of the questions and also allow the team to tackle some of those. Firstly, I think maybe what we would like to do, maybe I want to start there, in the future is probably to brief the different portfolio committees that falls within this task, so that we extend to trade and industry, police, communications, higher education, and all of that. And I think we'll just have to work with yourselves so that we get to put that type of a briefing. And I think just to also get a sense across, you know, all the portfolio committees in terms of the issues, but also to sensitize our other colleagues about the fact that these are also issues within the realm. Because I think the assumption is that this is an issue for art and culture, and that's why the president has put in place the task team. Whereas it's an issue that cuts across most of the government departments. I remember that you know, just not so long with regards to the last issue you were raising, you know, some of our colleagues in social development were saying, no, it's not their responsibility. It's the responsibility of us and culture. You know, so I think it would help, but it will also help with overall oversight, you know, so that we know that, you know, the most of those portfolio committees have got these issues on their pulse, and we're able to follow up on that. And I think that will help us with the coordination. And then when we come back to report, we'll ensure that we give as much details as possible to the portfolio committee. Now, the what the committee has done, or the task team has done, has essentially strengthened coordination in terms of intervention with regards to the issues. You know, so even where you know, certain departments were not making these issues their priority, but I think mainly because they have to come before the committee, I mean the task team, and report, and they're also given tasks and all of that. So work is actually done. I mean, there were a whole range of blockages. Yes, there is, you know, it's slow in terms of the white paper, it's slow in terms of the bill, you know, but because we have been pushing as a task team, you know, at least there have been some movement, you know. So I think that effectiveness of the task team has led to, you know, strength in terms of coordination and work being done by the relevant department, and I think also the fact that it is at a ministerial level, you know, with the deputy minister serving in the task team, also helps in ensuring that the work is done. Now, the issue of how the portfolio committee can support our work, I think I've already spoken about overall with all the other portfolio committees. But from, I think, what the you know, colleagues are saying, I think already with asking questions and you know, the oversight that has been played, already there is a lot of support that you know, I sense that we are getting. So
Even if there is a task team that comprises of the different portfolios in government, I think this committee is very crucial in terms of our work. So that's where it's somewhat the first port of call for artists in whatever they do, whatever trade they are in. So this portfolio committee would be their first port of call. So I think the work that the committee is already doing is actually helpful. What are the challenges? I think we assumed that because we're coming to the portfolio committee on arts and culture, we therefore did not elaborate on what the challenges that artists face. Now, what we did in the earlier slides that speaks to what the responsibilities of this committee, or rather the terms of reference of the task team is essentially to respond to what the president believes the challenges of the artists are. So essentially, government's coordination in responding to the concerns, catalyzing and accelerating the creation of a conducive environment for artists to contribute to the economy. I think as the chair said in her input, providing strategic platform for decision makers, which is what the task team is intended to do, interaction with government through all those people, and also receiving and discussing reports on government's implementation. The reality is that it is mainly the artists that we hear and we see on radio and television that whose challenges are all over there. But those who are in the crafts who even face bigger challenges, have not really been attended to. And what we've been able to do as a task team was to bring their challenges to the fore now and to ensure that all the government departments that are under the task team attends to those issues. So most of the time when we would speak about artists dying as paupers, reference would be made to musicians and actors, but we would forget that there are poets, there are sculptors, and all of that, who some of them, their work they're not paid what is due to them, which is what the bill intends to do in terms of intellectual property. So I think what we've been able to do is essentially to broaden the focus in terms of what we talk about in terms of art. So even the 90% local content may not necessarily cover those type of artists and their income. And many of them, die quietly somewhere in the corner without us knowing, essentially because maybe they were not, in our dining rooms every day on Generations or on whatever television show. So I think those are the type of artists that we also are saying, let's bring them to the fore. And the intention of the bill is to address some of those issues. And I think it would be helpful working together that we can then respond to and bring those type of issues to the fore. Then there's the question around the collecting associations. Firstly, there are many. I think we've now met with four or five of the collecting associations, which is a big challenge. A couple of weeks before the SABC announced the 90% local content, we had a meeting with the SABC COO and several of the collecting associations. And the big challenge there was that the collecting associations could not verify the people who are going to be paid the money. And we understood what the SABC was arguing, that we're not going to be paying the collecting associations money if they don't show us who they're going to pay that money. Is it going to go to the people whom the money is due to? You know, so and the last time we checked, you know, that has still not been sorted out. So that's the big issue. And what we've been in discussion with the SABC is that at least let's look at you know, paying artists posthumously, those who've already passed on. You know, and I think the rest of the other artists will have to deal with them as soon as the collecting associations have sorted out these issues. There is a one of the collecting associations which deals specifically with the issue that you know, your banks or your cell phone companies or your government departments. Now, I didn't know the correctional services play music, but there is a collecting association that's specifically dealing with that. And you know, so one of the things that's standing between what will happen is the bill. But what we've also committed to do now that we've dealt with the issues relating to the public broadcaster, that we'll now be engaging with you know, the private sector directly on issues that affect the artists. Now, a lot of us know about the 90%. I mean, we met with the CEO of the SABC. I think about 2 or 3 weeks before the announcement made by the SABC. The provision in the bill is 70%, which I think is important, because even if the SABC continues with the 90%, and I agree with the chair, it's not an individual's decision. It's a decision of the corporation, but also it's a decision which resulted from the engagement with the corporation and the Department of Communications by this task team. So you know, so at the time when we met with the COO, he committed, I think, 80%, and then in the announcement it was 90%, and we're all happy. But what I think it also does is it then compels all others, when we go and engage with them, you know, to commit to at least 70% that you know, is proposed in the. It's actually 80% that is being proposed in the in the bill. The vacuum will not be too long. I mean, we sympathize with Lotus FM, but I suppose the vacuum will not be for too long, and it's still too early to make a determination on the whether it has made an impact or not, the quantum in relation to the 90%. So we'll have to see in the next 6-7 months or so, around May next year, as to what has been the impact. But as you say, you know, the artists are very happy with the decision. Now, what is going to be the other bigger challenge is to ensure that the money doesn't end up with the collecting association, the money doesn't only end up with the music houses, the money doesn't end up with the with only the producers and all of that, but that the money actually goes into the pockets of artists. You know, if that doesn't happen, then we would not have succeeded as artists. And that's why we encourage the SABC to keep the money for as long as possible until the collecting association proves that the money is going to go into the pockets of the rightful owners. Now, artists dying as paupers, and yes, that's the big issue. You know, and I think although about 5 or more years ago it would have been a big issue, I don't know if it is a big issue now. You know, of course, doesn't mean that we shouldn't do what we're supposed to do. And secondly, of course, it also means that there are other factors that we have to take into consideration. We cannot have a situation wherein artists are a sensation today, and then tomorrow they do not have money. But the people who owns the stable in which those artists belong, are millionaires. And all the time, government is supposed to be the one that comes in order to bury those artists. So the intention of the law is to ensure that we resolve all these things. Now, we have put in place this sub-task team with labor, social development, and treasury in order to ensure that we put in place some social security for artists. Now, there are obviously big debates. Are artists workers? Do they regard themselves as workers? The current definition of a worker in the Labor Relations Act does not cover performing artists as workers. So if it doesn't, what measures need to be put into place in order to ensure that they are covered? And I think without saying this is ongoing, I think what we could commit is that sometime early next year, in the first few meetings of the portfolio committee, would like to come back and give you a report, probably in March or so, give you a report and say this is what has been done. So at least at that point we would have a sense of what direction we would want to see this going. And then how long is the task team going to be in place? I guess that's the question for the president. But I suppose if we are able to meet the expectations in terms of coordination of the work of the whole of government, then the task team would obviously then fade away in terms of its work, and then there's I don't know if anybody wants to add, there's certainly the questions around the Hawks. Yeah.
Thanks, Deputy Minister.
Yes.
Thanks, Jim. Just on the issue of some of the questions that was asked by some of the honourable members regarding the issue pertaining to the Hawks, the scope of what we do and how we police the internet issues. I think, can I just beg, maybe just a few minutes, just to give the committee some background into what we do, because these acts are rather a bit intricate. Just if I just explain it, will be over the top. Just to say that when we deal with issues of copyright, these acts are not just straightforward acts. It has it's a hybrid type of act. Hybrid in the sense of it has built-in mechanisms for your civil mechanisms, civil as well as the criminal issues. Hence, if one reads the act, you will see in some instances it speaks to issues of plaintiff. Now, plaintiff is a language. Let me also say I'm not a lawyer, but I've read here and there about the law. So, if you speak about plaintiff is a language used more in the civil procedure issues, when you sue people in the civil courts. Then, whereas in the criminal sense, you speak about an accused person or suspect. Now, this act, the Copyright Act, hinges on to your Counterfeit Goods Act again. Because now, when we charge somebody, you don't charge him just straight out in terms of the copyright thing. We charge him in terms of the Counterfeit Goods Act. Because in the Counterfeit Goods Act, it makes reference to copyright infringements, trademark infringements, and merchandise mark infringements. And I said I have just to take one step back, just for the members also to have an understanding of what we do and how we do it. Now, when I think in the minister's presentation, he touches somewhere on some difficulties that is there to be done also. Now, the Copyright Act, it speaks in section 24.1. It says that it is the prerogative of the owner of the copyright first to lay charges. It uses different wordings now. If I must quote it verbatim, it says, subject to the provision of the Act, infringement of the copyright shall be actionable at the suit of the owner of the copyright, meaning that in whoever ownership of that copyright vests. Yes, and whoever the ownership is shall be the complainant. Now we, as an institution, we cannot act proactively. You have to wait for somebody to lay a charge. And the reason for that is, you see, this is now a statute of offense, as opposed to where you have a common law offense where there's an assault, which is obviously against what is expected outside. It's against the moral high ground of you cannot do that to somebody else. Hence, we can act without somebody laying a charge if it is done in our presence. Now, if this is done in our presence, we would not know at that point in time whether the owner of that intellectual property right has an agreement with whomever is selling that item. Hence, we have to have that complaint stating that that person does not have any authority or permission from the owner of the copyright to do what he or she is doing by selling it or reproducing it or communicating it to somebody else in whichever form. Now, which means that we are now becoming very reactive, not by our choice, but because of the law. And we cannot assume. We are now opening, we will open ourselves up to civil suits whereby we would seize goods. And, you know, sometimes certain things get damaged when it's being seized. And we will be facing civil suits in that sense, either for wrongful action, or they can say we are malicious to some extent. Then, the other difficulty is when you speak about the Counter Goods Act, you know, these items, when it is seized, it is not taken to your normal police station where it's handed into an SCP-13 as an exhibit. Now, in terms of the Counterfeits Act, the Minister of Trade, he can now declare any place other than a police station as a counterfeits depot. And those items must be taken to that depot. Now, the minute it's taken to the depot, as the police, we have no control over those items there. And that depot owner has to be paid to keep those goods there. And the person who must make that payment to the depot owner is again the complainant, who is the person who is now complaining about, I will not get any proceeds from my art or whatever is being done in, but now he has to pay that depot owner. And I'm glad that this topic comes up, because I would love the Deputy Minister also. I'm campaigning against, we have to look at the Counter Goods Act in a manner, and even how the goods are handled there. The police do not have control over those items inside there, because by operation of the Act, the person in charge of the Counter Goods Depot is in charge, and we must go to them, although it's a product of a case that we must deal with. And that case hinges on that information and how it is kept there. So I would appreciate some of them. I think I'll also be involved to assist the Minister in that regard to put that case forward wherever the thing, when we deal with the amendment, because we have to look at the Counter Goods Act as well, because it also works counterproductive now towards the very issue of the IP owners here, which may include the artists. Now, secondly, when it comes to the artists, the issue of, in the past we had operations, Chair, where we were dealing with it, but when you deal as a police, we must more use JPMD from a disruptive operation perspective because of the impediments we have that we cannot act. Now, we must rather go to charge people to say you are trading without the necessary permit. Now, the moment they pay the fine, you have to give everything back because the charge is trading without a permit and the stuff we seize has got nothing to do with the charge. So you have to give it back to them. And that's part of the problem. And when we go out to deal with these type of cases of copyright, the issue of owner of the copyright becomes very imperative. Because here you have an artist who sings. But the artist is not necessarily the owner of the copyright. The owner of the copyright is based somewhere else. He may or may not be the owner of the copyright. And I think that's where the issues become now. In this Copyright Act, you sit with Section 9, just to assist also the task team, because the Section 9 deals with the issues of royalties and who must get the royalties and must be paid. Because you see, it also says the owner of the copyright will get the royalties, and he or she must then deal with the artist or the performer, who it may be at that point in time, for the payment of royalties due in terms of their agreement. So it becomes a whole contractual issue in terms of who pays who, what percentage. And I think the artists really do need protection in that regard, but also direction, assistance from a legal perspective. On the issue of the internet, I hope what I've said now in the run-up will have maybe cleared why it is difficult for us to deal and police the issue of the internet. Because it's an open source thing, everybody can go in, but you cannot do just what you want. If you go there to influence on somebody else's, if I upload music of Zwab, and I just copy it somewhere else, and I also distribute it, and people must, because every time they download it from my site, I get paid. It is still an infringement on whoever's music I'm doing that to. And still, the same principle will then apply as if somebody stands on the street corner and sells it. That artist must still go and lodge a complaint to which we must react. Thank you, sir.
Any follow-up questions?
Madame, you're the floor.
Thank you very much. I just want to go into some detail on the royalty payments and the new Copyright Amendment Bill and Performance Protection Bill to answer some of the questions that were made here. So basically, the bill is going to regulate collective management. In 2011, the DTI released the Copyright Review Commission report that made specific recommendations. And as a colleague pointed out, a lot of it is contractual. So we found that there were very basic minimum standards missing from the contract, date of payments, the right to have a dispute when you will cancel your contract. So what the DTI has done in the bill, we are saying we are going to set minimum contractual standards across the creative industry, not limited to musicians. We are going to have a tribunal system to replace an alternative dispute. So currently, all copyright issues are held in the High Court. It's very expensive. Artists don't have money. It's not accessible. And also, you don't always have the judge who has the IP expertise. So we are introducing a tribunal system where everybody will be allowed to come and lodge a dispute. So this will help alleviate the plight of the artist in terms of contractual agreements. Well, with collecting societies, all their expenses in terms of the law is capped at 20%. So for administrative costs, they're not allowed to exceed 20%. And now the new legislation is going to regulate every collecting society. They have to be registered at the CIPC, which is the Companies and Intellectual Property Commission. They will not be allowed to collect for non-members. They will not be allowed to distribute income that does not belong to them. This is all in the legislation. But what is more important is that we have identified that there are three IP rights specifically. So there are the needle time rights, which is the radio, there's performance rights, and then there's the mechanical rights, for example, when MTN plays a ringtone. So we are introducing that the collecting societies can only collect for one right holder group, not across the board. So if you're collecting for needle time, you can only collect for needle time. Now what we've also done, because the contracts were very unfair, we are introducing fair and equitable sharing, meaning there will be a 50% split between the copyright owners. The recording company will take 50% and the performer will be guaranteed a 50% of the income. We made a lot of additions as well into the performance protection bill, and the reason I'm mentioning this is that we will be acceding to a number of international treaties, the WIPO treaties, which is the WIPO copyright treaty, the WIPO performance and protection phonographs treaty, the Beijing treaty, which will give artists economic rights as well as moral rights, because that's something that artists don't have. They don't have control over their image. They don't have control over who may authorize what they do with that image, so that is in the legislation. And as Deputy Minister mentioned, the bill did touch on 80% for the radio stations, but we went one step further, and we said that there should be also an obligation on commercial stations, and 60% of the local content should be for any commercial radio station, not only public broadcasting. So the 80% was for public broadcasting. As I mentioned, the accession, we are working very hard with all the industries. We meet with your Vodacoms, we meet with your collecting societies, gearing them for the change. Everybody has accepted that they will be collecting for one right only. They know that all the distribution plans have to be accepted at the CIPC. But I think the main problem was really the collection of this, which has been handled. But in addition, as Deputy Minister pointed out, the bill is not only for musicians. We are introducing a new royalty for artists, crafters, because as you know, artwork escalates into value, and sometimes you just need a piece of bread and you go and sell your sculpture or your artwork for 20 rand or 50 bucks, and 10 years from now it's sitting in the thousands. So we are introducing a commercial reuse right for artists. So every time their work or piece of work is resold, they will be entitled to a royalty. And we're setting up a number of new collecting societies that do not exist in South Africa, even for the actors. Actors also have big problems currently. They are not receiving any royalties. So the DTI will be setting up a collecting society specifically for the actors, as well as for the crafters. And they will be all subject to the same principles we've introduced in the bill: one collecting society per set of copyright holders. You will have to be managed by the CIPC, as I've mentioned, and these contracts. So it's very important that the changes are there. We were already supposed to have commenced a portfolio committee in trade and industry. Unfortunately, the bills were delayed, but our first briefing is on the 22nd of November. And we have also started groundwork with the presidential task team for regulation. So the minute that the bills are promulgated, we will move into regulations that will speed up the implementation of the bills. We have noted the problems with the Counterfeit Goods Act, and there will be an amendment to 7 IP pieces of legislation. But the copyright was seen as the one that is hampering the payment of royalties. So to create that enabling environment, that's why this amendment is pushing ahead of the others. But we do note the problems that exist and the challenges, and we are working on that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members. I am just addressing the matter of the white paper because it actually comes out in the presentation as one of the concerns in terms of the speed, which I think is a fair comment. But just to say that this has been because of the consultation with the subsectors, with various subsectors, but also to say, Chairperson, we are clear to say that there is already a draft which was presented by the panel that has been tasked with the review of the white paper. Between the 17th and 18th of November, there's going to be an indaba, which then looks at the first draft for final refinements, which will then empower us early next year to go to cabinet. So I just thought that let me maybe take that advantage of
topic in that matter, but also the recommendation, and I'm glad, Chairperson, that you were the first to even check whether the Department of Arts and Culture has got the capacity to actually host the financial and advisory services. It's the recommendation, and I think that the Department of Arts and Culture will be looking at it, not that it should necessarily be the Department of Arts and Culture, but we also have agencies that we could be looking at that could be better positioned and might be much more better capacitated to look at those matters. So I think it's a good idea, but I think the exploration of what comes is what we will be doing. Thank you.
Chairperson, I think the presentation that we received from the lady there, that's what we really expected, because it's a detailed presentation, although we don't have it in front of us. I had a little bit of confusion. The 80%, 17%, and all of those things, really would want to get details on the 80%, 70%, 90%, and so on. Then, Chairperson, let me come to the last thing of the white paper. I think we have raised it on numerous occasions with the Department of Arts and Culture that the pace in which they are moving in terms of the implementation or the processes that of the white paper really is not good. When you go out there to do our own oversight, artists are always asking us about the issue of when are you going to implement the white paper, because they feel that there's a little bit of reluctance in the department to implement everything that is contained within the white paper, because they really feel that the white paper might also change the situation, the current situation that they are finding themselves in. Chairperson, I think we really, the Department of Arts and Culture really should move with speed in terms of the implementation or the whatever processes that are intake in the white paper. The second issue, Chairperson, is on the bill itself, the bill of the bill of the intellectual property, you name it. I don't know, Ubanayo, how far is the process? Because really, if it can also move with speed, and the other end of the thing isn't just by legislation, it's a misa, but with everything about legislation, as long as it's a misa, it's a misa, because it is very important that we, all the processes that are in the bill should move with speed, because it's really going to address a lot, it's going to address a lot of issues that are that will help our artists out there. I'm happy that the DM did mention the issue of the, I was very worried about the issue, especially the crafters. We have a serious problem of our own people who are doing a lot of work, and that work is taken overseas. Most of the crafters' work is taken up overseas. And after years, or let's say 10 years, if a person feels like selling that thing, the only person who's going to benefit is the one who is selling it. But the original artist or the original crafter who has done that would not benefit anything out of that. So I'm very happy that you really mentioned that. I'm really passionate about that, because I know where I come from. There are a lot of crafters who are doing very good work, but that work really is not recognized. Coming to the issue of the 90%. Who will only push everyone at 90%, because I didn't want to talk about it. I think in the presentation, the DM said that the legislation is talking about 70%, if I get it, I got it very well. But 80%, okay. Now, there is this very progressive announcement that was made by the SABC of a 90%. My worry is, okay, what I want to find out is that agreement written somewhere, because it's not a regulation, it's not in the bill, it is written somewhere, because remember that when somebody else comes in the SABC, the person who might say that I am confining myself with what the legislation is saying. The 90% one, I'm not going to deal with it. Let's deal with what is with the legislation. Now my worry is, whatever announcement that was made, as progressive as it is, what are the issues around that? Or should I also say, maybe perhaps the task team should also propose to move to 90%, because already the SABC has set the bar very high. So we should really try to move towards getting to the 90%. Also, the issue of the 90%, especially on the broadcasting, what worries me is the fact that there is an issue that it doesn't necessarily address the issue of social cohesion and nation building. Let me demonstrate what our citizens are saying. For example, for a person who is in the Free State, there will be Lesedi FM. The music that is played there predominantly will be your Sotho music, perhaps your Tswana, and then part of is Xhosa, and then South Africa. And then, now the other languages are not accommodated within Lesedi FM. Now, the issue of social cohesion doesn't come in, because now it doesn't address that. Instead, we segregate. That is what the people are saying outside. You get to Umhlobo Wenene. I always listen to Umhlobo Wenene every morning when I come to work here. Most of the songs that have been played today will be the Xhosa songs. You seldom get when you go to hip-hop, the days where they play hip-hop or they play house, that's when you'll be able to get the songs that are played in English. It will be predominantly English. But then now, the issue that we need to address, we are building a nation here. Does it really, have they looked at that the 90% is good, but at the same time, the different radio stations that are within the SABC, they seem to be predominantly playing the music. If we look at the FM is in KZN, obviously they will play predominantly the Zulu songs. They will not play necessarily the others. Who would want to hear the African song? Who would want to hear other languages within the languages that we have in our country? Can they really look at that? Because that's one of the issues that the citizens are raising, that is good, but at the same time, how they do it, it's a little bit problematic. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I was just wanting to ask my colleague whether homeless people can appreciate house music. One of the questions I wanted to ask was about the 60% commercial radio stations. Now, whereas the SABC focuses on 80 or 90%, that means your commercial radio station is, do I have it correct, it's at 60%, right? Now, the question that I wanted to ask now is, even though I do appreciate the financial advisory and planning services to artists, however, in this paragraph, nothing is mentioned about a pension fund for artists. I don't know if that has been set up. But when it comes to painters and sculptors and so on, I think that we will land in the whole quagmire of finances going around. I was just thinking about a painting done in way back during my student years. Now this painting changes hands and people are paying for it every time. But who ensures if that is not being bought by a big like Isiko museums or art collectors? Who collects, who will know I paid 10,000 rand for this painting? And this painter got 1,000 rand. I gave him 10,000 rand. Who collects that money? Sometimes it's only his initials are there. Nobody knows him. And I go overseas, I bought it 10,000, I go to the estate, and I sell it for 10 million. You understand? Nobody knows who the artist is. So I don't think that that money will get anywhere near the artist, with all due respect to the good work that you would like to do, because it will simply not happen.
You are bringing that complicated issue back again, I don't know that. Colleagues, any other questions, madam?
Just to say that when we came in 2014, the department was dealing with the white paper. Remember? The white paper was there already, and they were saying that they had done a lot of consultation. And I think with the bill as well, when you're saying that we've consulted so many people, tell us who you have consulted. Because the department will tell you that when they gave us the list of the people that they said they had consulted, they said the consultation is not enough. And it was true, because we have 9 provinces, they had only 4 provinces. So many provinces, I don't remember how many. So we said, you need to broaden the consultation. And I think one other thing that I think is important with the bill will be the tagging of the bill. Do you tag it as a Section 75 or a Section 76 bill? Because I think a lot of people need to input in this bill. So it has to be something that goes out for consultation. And also the challenges that you are faced with CIFSA, I think they need to give you lessons, those challenges. Lessons that are going to ensure that with the bill you won't face those challenges. Because you yourselves are saying in the presentation that there are people who disown the whole process. We're never part of that thing. You know? So I think it's very important that you broaden your consultation, ensure that you consult a lot of people. And also, like Honorable Tulezi, the issue of the crafters, and I think it's very important. Crafters, designers, and those people that feel left out, I think it's exciting to hear that the task team is giving them an ear, and there is work that is being done to bring them closer, because the exploitation that takes place there is something that we really, really need to look into. It's a matter of concern. When people are doing beadwork, they put beads around this pen, and someone will come and buy it for 50 rand. And sell it for 500 rand. So I think the exploitation that gets there is really a matter of concern. I think I heard the explanation about people having to go and complain when their cities are being sold by people by pirates. But I think in most cases, a number of cases, the artists go and report to the police, and the police don't act. And when they act, they are now the criminals. You know? It's sad. It's very sad. Because I go to report, nothing is being done. People keep on selling those CDs, and I asked because police are not doing anything, and now I am the criminal. It's criminalizing our artists, and I don't think it's good at all. So I think police should be sensitized to respond quickly when artists go to report the cases of piracy in their area. They need to be sensitized, because you won't sit there and watch people selling your CD at the corner of a street. You won't. You'll go to the police. If they're not acting, you'll find a way
of stopping this, and you are criminalized, which is not good at all. So it's our appeal that police must respond quickly when this when people come and report the cases of piracy. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. I guess colleagues have dealt with the issues. It would be interesting to know from those that are doing the act as to how they deal with the gaps that were, for instance, raised by the gentleman from the Hawks. Because I think it's a concerning matter. Can you imagine, you've got so many spaces in the country and the jurisdictional issues. I think the state the whole intervention by the state should make sure that it does not become an unnecessary burden. For an artist to fly here to Joburg, Kimberley, Polokwane, and wherever, to report him that a place, Ectoria, lower, because how we are going to see, I think it becomes a responsibility of the state. In as we have that, those laws that we protect the artist, but we make the police work also easy to take appropriate actions, I assume. Oh, it's actually lawmakers' responsibility. It's going to be difficult, but anyway, yeah, no, it's our responsibility. We will have to, but those in government must cut it in such a way that it helps us to make up. On a parting note, Minister, now this is almost coming home, you know. I hope that their protection that we are seeking to do for artists, and I know when I spoke earlier on, my preoccupation was more the music. I think for once I lost the whole spectrum of the artist community. But in the presentation, I think certain things have been brought back, and I hope that that old lady, Esther Mahlan, who is an artist, I think that the Germans still have some of this particular car. And now almost all of those people who are driving those expensive vehicles will have the artwork that she's done. And I hope that that protection will also abide to her for life, even beyond that, because it may be something that cars for future. I'm just saying that I think, and therefore locating this issue within that collective ministry of, collective of deputy ministers, very crucial. And I think the longer it lives until such time that we are sure that we've covered a lot of spaces, we will really appreciate it. Yeah, can I hand over to you, Congress?
Thank you. I think the first thing is that I want to raise is maybe to ask that the portfolio committee engages with the portfolio committee on trade and industry on the bill, and probably also make some inputs into the bill. Because I think there are very valuable points that the honourable members are making in terms of the issues around IP and copyright and all of that. We have said to the Hawks that they need to help us with legislative amendments so that we're able to deal with the issues that they are raising. Not only at a task team level, but also in relation to specific ministries that has to deal with those issues. So that would be the police, where they belong, and also the trade and industry. And as we've had, there is that bill in place. So I think some of those issues will have to come in there. I fully agree with regards to consultation and the extent of consultation and all of that. In fact, we said the same thing to the then DG of Arts and Culture when they presented to the task team about having consulted around the white paper. And we said to them, we do not think that you have even started with your consultation. And we think that you need to do more in terms of that consultation. So we're hoping that that consultation has been done and quite extensive. The issue of pensions, that the honourable member raised, that's part of the income smoothing issues, social security net issues that we've raised, and I've said that by March we would want to come back and preview on what progress would have made at that time. And I think the issue of the 90%, 80%, 60%, look, the 80% in the bill is the minimum that is provided for, and secondly, so in terms of public broadcasters, so that's the minimum, and secondly, there is no way that either government or parliament or artists themselves would allow the 90% to be reversed. It doesn't matter what happens, wherever, and all of that. There is no way that I think we, all of us, because it was as a result of prolonged struggles by artists. It was not because I wanted it so or whoever wanted it so. It is because artists fought for this to happen. And I don't see any government that would allow a situation where this is reversed. But over and above, the issue of compensation towards artists, this also has impact on a whole range of other issues on nation building, social cohesion, and all of that. I get the point around balkanizing our people in terms of music. So, the Sutras must only hear Sutra music and Xhosas, and I think that's one of the things that's got to be dealt with so that, the universality of music is appreciated in terms of the country. I think that the extent within which this will have an impact on the appreciation of our culture by young people, the appreciation of our language, the appreciation of our ethos, our history, our values, through music, has essentially come into play. I mean, I don't think that we would have seen, for instance, the way in which the younger generation appreciated, for instance, the role that Mandoza has played in the history of our music, quite in particular, had it not been of, with the 90% local, or knowing some of the artists who are now being played on radio. I really think that it has had far-reaching implications than only in terms of the pockets of artists. And maybe the final point that I want to raise is that what we're doing now is, of course, in the crafts and everywhere else, but the most immediate thing is in relation to the actors. The different associations that represent actors are, through our facilitation, engaging with the SABC to finalize a generic contract So our approach is we deal with the public broadcaster, and then that will then set the standard. So ETV and all of those others, we will also be engaging with them, but we believe if we've already set a particular standard with the public broadcaster, it is much easier to engage with people in the private sector. So we're dealing with the public broadcaster in terms of that. And I don't know, you probably are aware of a new channel, Encore, on SABC. Now, one of the things which we have to urgently sort out is the fact that you know, those artists who appear there have to be paid royalties, which is something that's not happening and that's not been happening. So, you know, it's those kind of things that want the SABC to clarify. And I think the good news, for instance, that ETV has moved in securing the generic contract for actors, which is in our view, and we think the actors' views also quite a good deal for many of them. So I think once more, then the question of CIFSA, I think DG at some point probably briefing to the portfolio committee on CIFSA may help. We it's something that we've also kept in our radar, because one of the things that the president has asked us to do is to help artists organize themselves. Because once you have that, then, you know, all the other fears would be reduced in terms of artists' rights being taken out. In fact, the vulnerability of artists is more as a result of their disorganization than anything else. And we've seen in areas where there's, you know, more proper organization and all of that, you know, the issues are actually very, very minimal. So the question of CIFSA is one thing that we're keeping on our radar. So thank you very much. I don't know if there's anything from... Okay? Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Council Minister, and
I think it's important for maybe us as the portfolio committee to have this joint meeting with all the committees that are affected, so that they don't have to report to this committee today to the other one, to have a joint meeting where they are going to present to all the committees that are affected.
Thank you. I guess that's how we conclude the discussion this matter. And once more, thank you for appearing and leading your delegation, and all of the best with this important initiative. Colleagues, that takes us to the next item. Oh, no, they have freedom to stay. Freedom of movement, freedom of association, as the constitution kicks in. Yes, Minister, thank you. Colleagues, we will take, because we are approaching 12 o'clock, we will take in the other matters. I don't know whether members would like us to take the item number 2, or you would like us to take item number 6, the presentation for this place. You can just advise. I don't know. Colleagues, we will then take item number 6, presentation.
Thank you very much. Honorable Chair and honorable members, this is the presentation of the forensic investigation outcomes on the Enyogeni Cultural Precinct project, which is the project that was requested by His Majesty, and the main purpose being to ensure that whenever there are ceremonies that Enyogeni, at least the maidens that attend, their thousands are accommodated. They've got accommodation, they've got there's good hygiene and sanitation. But of course, as you would see from the presentation that my colleague is going to be presenting, that things did not go the way they had been planned. Hence this forensic investigation that was conducted by Koboto Forensic Investigation. I think August 2015, that's when it was started, and I think concluded around January. And then, of course, out of those investigations, certain things have happened. We've even gone to do further assessments where we appointed Rubicund quantity surveyors to then just probe some of the things that were highlighted by the investigations, more particularly the value for money and all those kinds of things. And my colleague is going to touch on what those quantity surveyors are saying about, you know, the kind of work that was done and the amounts that were paid by the department. So without any further waste of time, may I take this opportunity through you, Chairperson, to allow our Director for Internal Audit in the department to give the detailed presentation of the report. Thank you.
Madam, that's you. You are welcome.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I will take you through the presentation that has been prepared, which is a high-level summary on the overall investigation. The contents, we have a short introduction and propose the background and investigation mandate, findings and conclusions, as well as recommendations and progress or the status of implementation of the recommended action. Chairperson, I will skip this particular slide and go directly to the background and the investigation mandate. The department appointed Koboto Forensic and Investigative Accounting to assist with the forensic investigation into the construction of the Enyogeni Cultural Precinct. This cultural precinct is a project that the department had committed itself to on the basis of a funding request that was made to the department. And there were also issues raised in the department's Auditor General report, which also included the Enyogeni, or rather the construction of cultural precincts. These were subsequently given to the Chief State Law Advisor to advise on how the matter could be taken forward. And in the answer or the opinion that the Chief State Law Advisor gave to the department, it was indicated that with specifically with regards to the Enyogeni cultural precinct, that perhaps the forensic investigation should be done to answer the questions that were raised. The mandate given to Koboto Forensic and Investigative Accounting was also to answer those questions that had been raised in the legal opinion. To go into some of the issues that were raised was the policy framework that governs the development and maintenance of cultural precincts. What is the approval process of such projects as required by relevant legislation such as the PFMA or Triple PFA? What were the project planning and acceptance considerations, i.e. were the feasibility studies done? What was the project plan that regulates the different stages of construction? And what documentation was in place to authorize the construction of the cultural precinct? What processes were followed and legal contract documentation that would be either SLAs or memorandum of agreements or any other form of agreement? What were the land ownership arrangements that were made, whether there were any transfer or lease agreements in place? what were the supply chain processes followed and documentation thereof, and what were the budget considerations. For example, what was the total budget approved for the project, were there any funds transferred from other budget allocations or projects for the construction, and were the processes of effecting such transfers followed properly, for example, if there were any requirements in terms of the PFMA, how much of the budget has been used from inception to date, and what is the percentage of completion of the project as certified by professional quantity surveyors and architects, what payments have been made to date on the basis thereof of the completion, and also how much of the budget is left for the MTF period and perhaps beyond this period for the conclusion of the project, and any budget overrun envisaged, and if so, how much is it and how will this overrun be financed? Subsequent to those questions being raised, Chairperson, the department appointed Bobot on the 25th of August 2015 to do the investigation and address or rather establish any findings with regards to the cultural precinct. The investigation was finalized in November 2015 and a final report was issued to the department in January 2016. With regards to the findings that came from the investigation, it has been established that there was no proper planning for the Enugian Cultural Precinct project within the EEC, and the IDT, which was identified as the implementing agent on behalf of the department. The applicable legal framework was also not considered or applied. Critical issues such as land ownership considerations, budget arrangements, as well as the necessary contractual arrangements, to name but a few, were not considered or provided for. The summary of the facts established from the forensic investigation will follow from here on, Chairperson, in much more detail. As the acting DG has indicated, the DAC had received a request for capital funding and financial support to inter alia extend the Isibubu cultural arena and related construction works, the provision of concrete platforms for the erection of sleeping marquees for approximately 35,000 to 50,000 maidens attending the annual returns, the provision of semi-permanent marquee structures, and the provision of bathing and ablution facilities. Chairperson, in terms of the presentation, because it was quite a little bit difficult to structure it properly, we've tried to frame it so that it's easy to put the findings on the table. We will start there with the DEC's approval process of the request for funding. The investigation has revealed that there was no formal process that initiated the Enyakene project. The DEC decided to finally assist after receiving a formal request to do so. And with regards to the process, the other issue is that in terms of legislation, we could not conclude that any form of legislation applied to Enyokeni or was consulted with regards to Enyokeni. The report is citing there the National Heritage Resources Act, number 25 of 1999, and the Culture Promotion Act, number 35, which ordinarily would have given heed to the department to decide on a project like this. The South African Heritage Resource Agency also would have been such a piece of legislation that could have been considered in this particular project. Chairperson, as we go deeper, you will see why this particular piece of legislation, which could have been applied, did not apply with respect to Enyokeni, mainly because it was treated as a heritage site. However, it should have been a project of financial assistance, as opposed to being
a project that is declared as a heritage site and therefore supported by the DAC. There is no specific policy framework that governs cultural precincts, and as such, the project could have been classified as a financial support or assistance to an entity or organization as opposed to capital works or infrastructure related project. The DAC at the moment, especially for this cultural present, did not have a criteria or process, an evaluation panel for evaluating requests for funding. The investigation team was informed that as the projects are cultural or heritage related, a grant in aid can be given if there is political support or an instruction for it, and if the accounting officer deems it appropriate. The DAC's normal approval process would then follow. So ordinarily, that should have been the process of treating it as a grant in aid or a project of financial assistance. There was no evidence of any feasibility study being undertaken with regard to supporting the adoption of this cultural precinct, and no evidence was found also in general. The project was also neither part of the annual performance plan of the department, and the project was also not part of the MTEF allocation of the department. With regards to the planning and budget arrangements, the DAC on the 11th February 2014, according to correspondence that was evidenced, estimated that the total cost of the project would be 225 million. And on the 7th of March 2014, a budget of 129 million was approved for this particular construction of the Enyobeni Cultural Crescent, and this was from an underspending of the 2013-2014 capital works budget. As the project could qualify as a legacy project, it should have been managed by the Heritage Institution Development within the branch Heritage Promotion and Preservation. However, the project was initially and for most of the construction period managed from the DG's office by a senior official in the DG's office, which was appointed as the chairperson of the project steering committee for the project. And this was, of course, to the exclusion of the heritage and infrastructure units in the department, which ordinarily would have had to deal with this particular project. And the investigation has also found that the senior official referred to above had no formal construction or built environment qualifications or experience, and also disregarded important preparatory work which should have been done during the planning of the project. The following theme, the chairperson, is under establishment of a project office, and we've indicated DAC there in brackets. The investigation revealed further that there were additional consultants to manage the Enyobeni Cultural Crescent project on behalf of the DAC, together with the DAC senior official mentioned before. The two consultants were appointed as single source appointments on about 22nd August 2013 by the former DG in the soon-to-be-established project support office, and were to assume duties the next day on the 23rd of August 2013. These two consultants were paid 1.7 million for the period of August to December 2014, and the next consultant was paid 2.4 million for the period of August 2013 to September 2014 respectively. There is a third consultant that was appointed to the project, which was a consultant already appointed within the DAC and was made part of the project support office, although the role of this consultant was not entirely clear from the documents evidenced and the interviews held. Further to these consultants within the DAC, there was an official who was also allocated to assist with the management of the project, although in a more junior capacity to assist with project meetings. Further to the above project support office within the DAC, there were involvement of other entities in the construction of the Enyogeni project. The former DG before then had appointed IDT on 8 November 2013 for the implementation of heritage and library projects of the DAC, specifically requesting that the project management office be formed. At the time, Chairperson, this was to implement certain legacy and library projects. Enyogeni at that point in time was not part of those particular projects. The DAC reached an agreement in the form of an MOA, Memorandum of Agreement with IDT on 16 January 2014. On 12 March 2014, the DG sent a letter of instruction to IDT to proceed with the urgent implementation of the Enyogeni Cultural Precinct, Nongoma, as a matter of urgency. This is when now the Enyogeni Cultural Precinct project was now introduced within the MOA that the department had with IDT for the other approved projects. This letter further stated that a contractor was required to commence the works by no later than 4 April 2014. It was also indicated that the total allocated budget for the project is in the region of 100 million. The IDT appointed a service provider for professional services on the 27th February 2014, which was then later, specifically now appointed as principal agent for the Enyogeni project on 14 March 2014. This particular service provider for professional services was appointed for the initial approved library and heritage projects by IDT, which were done formally and according to procedure. However, this same professional service provider was then now appointed specifically now for Enyogeni on the 14th of March 2014. At the time of the investigation when we concluded, the service provider had been paid 20.528 million. Continuing on the involvement of other entities, on the 24th of April 2014, the IDT then appointed a contractor for phase one of the Enyogeni project, and this was on the basis of a schedule of rates rather than to a bill of quantities being done. The approved tender amount that was that the IDT appointed this particular build contractor was 93.8 million. And the investigation revealed that various items which had no relevance to the existing works and also have apparently not been requested by anyone to the value of 15 million were included in the bid document. This would be issues like fire systems, security system, portable accommodation and ablution, a public address system, training and media towers. This was within the items within the tender that IDT advertised and appointed this particular contractor now for. And the procurement process followed by IDT in respect of the contractor was probably neither transparent nor fair, as it is not possible to make a fair comparison between the rates and of different bidders unless there are bills of quantities attached to it. It is that issue that the advert was on the basis of a schedule of rates as opposed to a proper bill of quantities. Chairperson, when we get to the land and site management arrangements, no research was done.
Is the ox living? They must remain.
The matter in front of us is a hawk's matter, but he's not assigned to it, so we will
There's
a copy for you. The matter is referred to yourselves, obviously. You are dealing with it.
Yes.
We expect agent arrest. But you can take a copy. Thank you. You're welcome. Have you taken the correct copy?
Yes, sir.
Okay, perfect.
You can proceed, ma'am. Thank you. When we get to the land and site management arrangements, it was found that there was no research done in conjunction with SAVA to possibly declare the site a heritage site prior to the work being started. No proper consideration was given as to what were the real pressing issues and what was affordable. This would be on the basis that the main basis of the request from the beneficiary was that they required assistance with accommodation for the maidens that come to the residence on an annual basis, and as well as ablution facilities. Those were the main issues. No proper consideration was given to the question regarding the ownership and maintenance of the site after completion thereof. And similarly, proper legal arrangements that are concluded between all stakeholders. For example, the land on which the construction has been done, as well as the registration of such agreements against the title deed of the property in question, were not considered and or executed as a result. Maintenance becomes an issue because the land becomes belongs to the Ingonyama Trust. There was no surveying of the site with a view of subdividing or rezoning the land to ensure that the rights over the site are properly secured for that site only and do not extend over a larger portion than necessary. With regards to the construction, the site handover to the contractor was done on 24 April 2014. This meant that construction took place while the consultants were still busy with the design. The project therefore was commenced without proper planning. No proper consideration was given to what is really needed for the redense event that only lasts for a few days each year, and to the real pressing issues and what was affordable. We have mentioned already that there was no research regarding the cultural needs of all traditional leaders and how such would be equitably funded. With regard to the actual construction process, issues such as a proper scope of work, a defined budget, a detailed bill of quantities, planning permissions and authority, the environmental impact assessment, and geotechnical surveys were not properly considered before the project was embarked on. With regards to fruitless and wasteful expenditure, it has been found that the contractor deviated from the contract in that it used subcontractors appointed by itself instead of using selected subcontractors, with the result that the contractor's charges for the preliminaries were more than what it should have been. The contractor here, ordinarily what would happen is that the principal agent would assist with the appointment of subcontractors. However, the contractor in this case used his own subcontractors as opposed to those appointed by the overseeing professional services, which is the principal agent. The contractor appointed by IDT was paid 11 million for items which did not contribute to the value of the infrastructure. For example, the cost of an excavator for the salt tailing ceremony, to remove litter after the Reed Dance Festival, for water cuts, a grader and staff to assist during the Reed Dance Festival, for security guards at the Shende Festival, to repair damage caused by trucks during the Reed Dance Festival, to execute work on the existing Palisse's French drain as requested by the royal household, and for work to the palace as instructed by the king. The aforesaid amount can therefore possibly be regarded as fruitless and wasteful expenditure, since it had nothing to do with the actual construction. Continuing on possible fruitless and wasteful expenditure, the rates charged by the contractor were substantially higher than the market-related rates, and in some cases higher by more than 200%. The calculated difference between the contractor's rate and the market rate amounted to 20 million. This amount can therefore possibly also be regarded as fruitless and wasteful expenditure. The maiden ports, which from the onset were an essential part of the project, were not constructed, and the budget saved on the ports was mainly spent on the VIP section and the Royal Square. By comparing the preceding scopes of the work that the DAC finally received, it is Kobodo Forensic Investigative Accounting's conclusion that the primary objective of the project was not achieved. The environmental impact assessment, which was not done at the beginning during the planning, was used as a reason for not building the maiden ports. And it is conveniently so in the view of Kobodo Forensic Investigative Accounting's view. During the Enyogeni Cultural Prison meeting of 20 June 2014, a 2.5 kiloliter water tank and 2 kilometer sewer lines were now included in the work package 1E, which was for the first phase. The third items were not previously included. A 2,614 kiloliter water tank was found during a site inspection that was conducted by the investigation team. This is 1,000 times larger than the 2 kiloliter water tank referred to in the meeting. A budget for this could not be located for this particular water tank. Could not be located, and it is therefore assumed that the work package 1E, which was for the maiden spot, probably funded this particular water tank, which however was larger than that which was indicated. It is GFIA's belief that the construction of the reservoir was probably overzealous without proper research into alternatives, as the facilities are only used for a few days per year. They were meant for to assist during the residents. The principal agent appointed by IDT probably misrepresented the statutory fee rates as pertaining to them. The approved statutory fee for acting as a principal agent is 1%, and they have indicated that they are entitled to a charge of 4%, which is 3 million more than the statutory fee. This is on the basis of the 100 million budget that was indicated earlier. The statutory fee for the normal services of the principal agent included a fee for construction monitoring up to stage 2. However, it appears that the additional fee of 450,000 was allowed for construction monitoring to make provision for the resident engineer, also appointed as the principal agent, to be on site 2 days a week. In the investigation team's view, and irrespective of whether or not IDT had agreed to this additional 450, the said 450,000 may be regarded as paying twice for the same service and consequently as fruitless and wasteful expenditure. In this case, the principal agent was appointed to oversee the project and further almost appointed itself to do additional construction monitoring for 2 days a week, whereas they are there already monitoring the project. If the PA, which is also the resident engineer, held to the original fee rate of 12%, then it would mean that they are entitled to a fee of 14 million and not the 20 million that was indicated earlier that has been paid already to them. It would have the further consequence that the balance of 5.5 million can possibly be regarded as fruitless and wasteful expenditure. In this particular instance, the original fee rate was 12%, which was communicated to IDT by the principal agent. However, this later changed to 17%. In addition to the fact that the IDT found that the principal agent's management of the project was very poor, as its approach was more cost-driven towards attaining the 100 million cost milestone and not towards the controlling of cost overruns, it is the investigation's view that the DAC may not have received proper value for money in respect of the services rendered by the principal agent. The principal agent, also resident engineer, had already made a presentation regarding New Guinea on 7 March 2014. This was the week before they were appointed for the project. The aforesaid is in the investigation's view, once again indicative of the absolute haste that the project was started, disregarding good corporate governance and without following due process. The DAC made two payments to the IDT, the first payment being for 54 million on 31st March 2014 and a second payment of 77 million on 31st March 2015. This all in all totals 132 million. This exceeded the budget of 129 million approved by the PG on the 7th of March 2014 by an amount of 2.2 million, which could be regarded as unauthorized expenditure. The project budget, the projected budgets for the project are extremely confusing and not entirely clear, and appear to have been randomly chosen. The last forecast by the IDT surveyors dated June 2016 estimated the budget for the finalization of phase 1 at 13.5 million and for phase 2 at 894 million. Resulting in a total projected cost of 1 billion. The lack of a proper planned, considered, and approved budget upfront has probably led to the various scope and consequently budget changes and made the project basically incapable of being properly audited. In terms of value for money, the conclusion is that according to Kobodo Forensic Investigation, investigative accounting, the current value of the project is 91.5 million. Apart from the fact that the DAC did not derive full value for money from the construction works, it is in GFIA's view that an amount of 40 million can further be possibly be regarded as fruitless and wasteful expenditure, this being the difference between the payments made by DAC and the current value of the project. This would be that 132 million less this 91 million which has been which is the value that has been placed on the construction by quality surveyor, which was working with the investigation team. The DAC has probably not received proper value for money from the involvement of a plethora of consultants at a combined cost of 20.2 million. The cost of the two consultants appointed by the DAC in the project support office amounted to 4.1 million. And for the consultants appointed by IDT, it was 16 million. And the IDT, together with the principal agent, at a combined fee of 28 million. Should have been adequately equipped to perform the functions of the the consultants performed. The agency of the New Guinea Cultural Project was not properly motivated or documented. In respect to the specific issues raised by the Chief State Law Advisor and which have not been dealt with above, the investigation concludes as follows. There was no proper feasibility study done for the project. There was no proper business plan to ensure sustainability. As the funding is in the nature of a grant, service level agreements would not be applicable. However, a memorandum of agreement should have been concluded with stakeholders, and this was not done. Instead, there is only an MOA between the department and the IDT. The land on which the precinct was constructed does not belong to the state, but it is public land belonging to the Ingonyama Trust, There is no agreement in respect of the land, therefore the land remains the unencumbered property of the landowner. There is also consequently no lease of the land. The DHC has no legal rights with regard to the land and conversely also does not have any obligations in respect of the land, for example, maintenance. As all buildings are fixed to the land, the buildings that were constructed are owned by the landowner. As the nature of the funding is a grant, the DAC supply chain management processes are not relevant. The DAC, however, agreed with IDT to implement the construction of the precinct. The procurement deviated from IDT's normal procurement processes due to an alleged agency. However, it is GFIA's view that the project was not urgent. It is unclear as to what the total approved budget for the project is. The only budget evidence as approved by the then DG on the 7th of March 2014 amounts to 129,854,000. Funds for the project were transferred from an underspending of the capital works budget, and although the project was financed from the capital works budget, it does not form part of DAC's immovable assets. The use of the capital works budget to finance a grant or subsidy such as any gain without National Treasury's written approval may constitute unauthorized expenditure. The initial budget of 129 million has been overspent by an amount of 2.2 million, which can also be regarded as unauthorized expenditure. Apart from the current budget overrun, extensive budget overruns are envisaged as not all the project items were done. For example, the maiden's costs were not done. Payments made by the DAC were made on the basis of invoices from the IDT. As the scope of the project had continually changed, it is nearly impossible to say what percentage of the initial project has been completed. There is no approved budget left to complete the project. The conduct of the then DG probably constitutes a violation of Section 38(1) of the PSMA. The senior official of the DAC placed in charge of the project from the DAC side did not ensure that the DAC received value for money from the project. This caused irregular and or wasteful and fruitless expenditure. The senior official's conduct therefore constitutes misconduct. The recommendations that have been made, Chairperson, together with the status of implementation. The first recommendation there is that the DAC should consider having an approved and yearly documented criteria and process in place which should address the stages and requirements for funding for cultural villages and museums, and that the accounting officer should consider appointing an adjudicating committee which will adjudicate such requests from different institutions or individuals. The action that is indicated there is that the department has sought to address this recommendation through an overarching policy to be informed by the white paper on arts and culture, which has undergone review and is being finalized. This policy and process or funding model will seek to address the current risks which have become apparent from the audits and investigations conducted in the department. The next recommendation, the recommendation number three, is that the DAC, together with all role players, should decide on a strategy going forward, and specifically which items will be included for finalization of the project. The DAC, together with all role players, once more should decide on the roles and responsibilities of the DAC and those role players, i.e., in respect of maintenance, to ensure that the construction that has taken place does not become the proverbial white elephant, that once the roles and responsibilities have been decided upon, proper legal agreements are concluded between the parties for the finalization of critical aspects of the project. The status or actions that have been indicated there, project finalization prioritized areas, Phase 1 prioritized elements for completion are an amphitheater roofing, ablutions, kitchenette, office with reception holding and change rooms, parking, landscaping, and water and electricity supply. The next areas prioritized as phase 2 is on the accommodation facility comprising of the following. The removal of poor soil, off-site spoiling and refill with imported suitable soil, a feasibility study, an environmental impact analysis and geotechnical assessment, construction of the dormitories, including rooms for caregivers or guardians, ablution facilities, industrial kitchen, office reception and courier shop, parking outside sitting steps, paving and landscaping, security kiosk and fencing around the dormitories, water and electricity supply. The DAC has written to the National Department of Sports and Recreation to request participation in the existing construction contract, which is permitted in terms of paragraph 16A6 of the Treasury, 16A6.6 of the Treasury Regulation. This approach would allow the conclusion of the project within a shorter time frame, and a response is pending this particular procurement. A meeting was held on 1st December 2016 with Nongoma Municipality Municipal Manager, Heads of Departments of Planning, Social Services, Technical Services, and the KZN DAC Chief Director. The municipality has to endorse all structures within its boundaries and include them in their planning frameworks, including their management plans. Follow-up KZN DAC infrastructure meetings with the stakeholders will be held to formalize the roles and responsibilities in proper legal agreements. This is a work that is still continuing, and consultations that are still continuing. With regards to recommendation number 6, in respect of instances of possible unauthorized expenditure or irregular, as alluded to in this report, it was recommended that the DAC approaches National Treasury and the AGFA for their views and or ratification before such expenditure is reflected as a regular expenditure in the financial records of the department. This recommendation has been partially implemented and is in progress. The department has appointed a service provider, a quantity surveyor, to value and quantify the actual cost of the project, irregular, fruitless and wasteful and unauthorized expenditure. To date, the irregular expenditure amounting to 4.947 million has been disclosed. This is only for the IDT management fees, which are resulting from the department not following the SCM processes when appointing IDT. Fruitless and wasteful expenditure resulting from the overcharging and non-construction related items as per the report of the forensic report and the quantity surveyor is still to be quantified. The department is awaiting the IDT's response on the quantity surveyor's report, which has been communicated to IDT prior to the department finalizing the disclosure and the financial records. The regular expenditure incurred when IDT appointed further contractors and consultants has not been, could not be verified since there was no DAC representative involved in the procurement process. However, that is also still the matter that is dealt with in terms of classification of the irregular, fruitless, wasteful and unauthorized. Recommendation number 7, the DAC and IDT should appoint a task team to reconcile the amounts that the DAC may be owing to the IDT, as well as to calculate any overpayments that may have already occurred. An expenditure report on the utilization of the funds transferred to IDT for New Guinea has been requested by the department and was submitted by IDT. The above report was submitted to the quantity surveyor appointed by the department to assess the quality and completeness of the work by IDT, and the assessment of evaluation report has revealed that there is an overcharge of 28 million. The process of finalizing any recoveries as a result of the amount overcharged can only be made after IBT has responded to the overcharging, and the process of engaging IBT is underway. There is a report that the quantity surveyor finalized, and it has been issued to IBT for their reply. The final report on the investigation should be forwarded to the Chief State Law Advisor to provide an opinion regarding the possible civil recovery, disciplinary action, and criminal liability with specific regards to possible civil recovery. And it has also been recommended that the report be forwarded to the State Attorney. The status of implementing the recommendation, the report has been communicated to the State Attorney in Pretoria for possible civil recovery. The State Attorney has further appointed two counsels, senior counsels, who are currently reviewing the matter for purposes of advising the department on the extent of the recovery that can be instituted against the relevant parties or contractors. This will be, it was anticipated that this will be delivered to the department at the end of October 2016. However, follow-ups are being done. The legal opinion also includes the review of all monies due and payable between the parties. The above will also incorporate the valuation work done by the quantity surveyor as mentioned above. The DAC should consider taking action against the senior official appointed to manage the Enugeni Cultural Crescent project disciplinary, and against the then DG for criminal charges. Disciplinary actions, the senior manager against which the disciplinary action was recommended left the employ of the department during the process of the DC charges being served. The charges have been transferred to the senior manager's current employer in line with the Public Service Act as amended, and was done through a letter communicated to the official's current employer, and a subsequent meeting was held on the 26th, September 2016. Further consultations between the DAC labor relations and the official's current employer continue. With regards to criminal charges, the recommended criminal charges have been registered with the Hawks. Affidavits by both the department and the Board of Forensic Investigative Accounting were submitted for further criminal investigation, which is underway. The registered criminal charges in respect of the Enugeni Cultural Prison relate to the former accounting officer of the DAC for violation of Section 38(1) of the PFMA, the former acting accounting officer of the DAC for contravention of Section 86(1) of the PFMA, and also against a service provider appointed by the IDT in respect of the Enugeni Cultural Prison project for misrepresentation of statutory. That is the end of the presentation, Chairperson. Thank you.
Is that all from the department? Colleagues, there is a report, and our time is limited. Terrible report, for that matter. And I guess it's a report that us as portfolio will have to do. I think it's the first time that we have such a bad report in front of us. So it's going to be quite an important matter for us to meticulously deal with it. And my view is that they will have to take off our gloves and deal with the matter sufficiently. We should leave no stone unturned on a matter of this nature, so that we actually can send a message about how intolerant we are to wrongdoing and actually corruption. As I've mentioned that we may not have sufficient time to deal with the matter, I don't know how colleagues would want us to deal with the matter. I think, first of all, let's deal with that aspect of procedure before we delve into any substantive matter. Mother?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I think I share the same sentiments like yourself. We really need sufficient time to engage in the report
because there are a lot of questions here that would really want clarity on. So I don't know whether the time that we are having, we're having almost 30 minutes, which for me I feel that it's not sufficient. So I would really propose that let's then take it to the next meeting in terms of the deeply engaging with it. Not unless we say we extend our time and not have lunch for today and then we deal with the report. Because remember, we've got a plenary immediately after, actually at 2 o'clock, we have a plenary that we have to go to. So I think it's a matter that we all as the honourable members have to decide on it, whether we forfeit our lunch today, we deal with the report extensively, or then we then take the report to the next day. But like you said, the report that really needs us to engage with it thoroughly and leave no stones. Yeah, because there's serious issues that are in the report that one would want to engage with extensively. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you, Chair. I think I would concur with my colleague, because I've got a string of questions, even with the report itself. I would concur that we do need more time to engage with this report, and I will be led by the Chair.
What is the view? Oh, Chairperson.
The order, can you shut your mic?
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Chair. It's a really horror story. One of those stories of two sides, really Papa said. This is what we have here. It's a horror story. And I think I support what honorable members have said. But also the manner in which the report has been crafted, I think the department needs to look into that as well, because there are areas where I think as the portfolio committee we need more information. Like for instance, if you're saying that you have a 28 million overcharge, in which area is this? You look at it and give us the details that is going to answer that, so that we don't ask you questions and you, when responding, you raise more questions. You need to organize. And the spirit that is here, the spirit that is that comes from the department through this report, I don't think they know, that they feel the sensitivity of this thing, the seriousness. I don't think the department feels the seriousness of this thing. I'm looking at at the recommendations and what they have done. I don't feel it. I don't feel that they know how serious this thing is. Maybe I may be wrong, I don't know. But it doesn't come out of the action that you are taking to address the issues that were raised by the forensic audit. I don't feel it yet. I may be wrong. And you know, look at the investigation. You first investigate the officials before you come to the accounting authority. Because they are saying that the senior official, and then if you look at part 3 of the section 9, that part number 9 of the thing, they say the DAC should consider taking action against the senior official appointed to manage. Accounting officer Kala. It comes first. The accounting officer comes first, and then the other official definitely will come after the accounting officer. The manner in which you have crafted it, it doesn't give us a sense that you know the seriousness of the report. So I think that honorable members are right when they say that we need more time. But the department should also look at the report, look at the report, and ensure that you give us all the information that is going to ensure that we get what we need to know and then to act accordingly. Thank you, Chair.
Makonda, we wanted to come in?
Yes,
to support the view that we may not necessarily have sufficient time to deal with this matter. I think it needed the whole day, so that we deal with this matter and we dispose it off. That's my view.
You wanted to come back again?
Chairperson has just reminded me that some of the issues are really missing. I don't know some of the, like the contractor, aren't we supposed to know? Because already it's a report that is out there. So aren't we supposed to know? Because there are a lot of things that are missing. Because one would be interested, who is the contractor, which contractor, what happened? So all of those details that are missing here, chairperson, would really... It will be necessary for them to put them. For an accounting officer, we know that who was the person who was an accountant. But then for the official, there are a lot of officials. Maybe the official is still sitting with us there, or like they said, is with another employment. Is it a secret with that person to the portfolio committee? Because I don't think it should be a secret to the portfolio committee, because the person was appointed in the position, who was appointed to be a project manager. Those are the things that are missing really in the report. I don't think really we need the portfolio committee to always have to dig for the information that the information should be given to us.
Thank you, Chair. I was just thinking about by myself here. We will be dealing with a mini Nkandla here. Also the only thing is which is omitted in this report that I hope when the department comes back is that from who did they get, you know, say, go ahead. Because this is not stated in this report. I have read the report.
Colleagues, I think as colleagues have reflected, we will postpone the matter for next week. What it means is we should shift everything that we needed to do next week and deal with this report first. But in preparation for us to deal with the report next week, I think it is fair that we get the forensic report itself from Kobodo, complete report, because this report does not give us sufficient information. I think the query that members are raising around the low level of energies that come out of the reporting recommendations, and the fact that there are individuals that has to be, that we need to know. We've got quite a few format DGs, so we can make an assumption that we know when we actually don't know. So we need that. But I think if that report also speaks about former and officials, we need their names. For us, we need to know, because we can see that somewhere they are being forgiven already, that, okay, we've transferred matters to their next employer. And I don't know, on matters of jurisdiction, whether if I'm employed and I do something wrong here, and I leave when I'm charged and we are told, no, we are transferring this thing to the next employer, that person's got nothing to do with that person and what he did. So jurisdiction-wise, whether that department would have appropriate jurisdiction and they would give the proper sanction, I don't know. My view is that if crime is committed here, it has to be dealt here. So we cannot transfer our responsibility to someone else. As much as we are not going to transfer our oversight to another portfolio about that official, to another department about that DG, you will have to appear an account to this portfolio. So we need their names and their addresses, including that of the DG. We want to know who the DG is and where is he. Colleagues have asked for contractors that we will need to know. But I guess we will need more information in the DG. You see, it will assist us to have an appreciation of what we are talking about. There is not even a single picture here that indicates as to what is this. Obviously, a lot of irregularities that have gone, and a serious contradiction with what we had received in certain events in the past, in this portfolio and this one, the way things have been treated. This one treated differently from the other. So I think all those, all that information will need to come. But there's another important question which I think you should help us with in preparation for that hearing. Because I see that from the report, the department has moved forward to do certain things. Apparently informed by the recommendations by Kobodo. It sounds very strange to me because it looks like there's already some level of coordination. But I think we will need to get all those details, Dichi, so that we can make an informed decision. And like I was saying, give us everything, literally everything. Give us that report, and if you need to rework this presentation, highlight those areas that require attention. But I think we must commend you for one thing, that you brought the report to us, although a bit later, but at least we have the report. Some people may have kept the report to themselves. We have it as a report, and I think we have to deal with the report appropriately. So colleagues, the report, therefore, is scheduled for deliberation next week, on Tuesday, we'll know of the committee and what it's called. If we possibly can do, but we'll arrange that internally, perhaps we should start earlier, if it's possible, so that, because we only have half a day, we can only work until latest 12:30. So I think if we could just sacrifice some of our time in the morning so that we deal with this matter sufficiently, it will be the only agenda item for us to deal with next week. Well, the rest of the other matters, do you mind if I leave them open or standing? Then we'll deal with them so that we allow members to even digest this information. Did you, when can we get the forensic report, sir?
Chairperson, the forensic report is there. Maybe just to indicate, Chairperson, that when we were doing this presentation, we're pains in terms of what we can include and what we cannot include, because some of these matters still are going to be dealt with by the courts of law. That's why you would see where we are not putting names of contractors. That's where we are trying to even not put names of the officials involved. But we're taking the point of the committee. We'll go and consult. If it is indeed permissible that we can actually give you the entire report, we will do so. But I just want to say that we will always exercise caution in terms of what we do and what we do not do, or what we are allowed to do and what we are not allowed to do. Okay.
See, I'm sure you know the rules that apply here. The committee's work is directed by the Constitution and the law. We can call on you to take an oath as you make the presentation. So there's nothing that you can hide from the committee. We are an oversight committee. Members would know if there are matters that are before the court, if they are. If they still will be, that matter does not apply. If it's a past issue, it can apply. It can apply. But if there is a matter that is before the courts of law, we may not reflect on the competency or unduly influence the decision of the court. You can read the Constitution, you can read the law, you can read the rules of Parliament. So we have a right to have everything, including other things that we may demand over and above what we have. If the report does not say as to how those decisions were arrived at, we may demand to get to know as to where yourselves were when the decision was taken. And so on, a host of other things. Why was it not in the APP? You know, all those things. Because I don't know what the forensics say. But for us, the starting point is that every expenditure that happens in the department has to be informed by your annual plan, your five-year plan, your annual performance, APP. That's where we start, and then we can then delve into other things there. Because only the DG is mentioned, and it is strange that the CFO does not feature. You know, that's very interesting, because the important law that applies here is the PFSA, and I can't imagine that there would be a DG who would execute, make a requisition and issue money. There must be a CFO. So all those things we will have to get it, and I don't know why it doesn't appear. We only see the project manager, but the man or the person who is assigned by the PFMA to carry this responsibility. You raise issue of a political decision or something, or request, or it's something very interesting here. Here we do not account to anyone. Remember, we account to ourselves. We account to Parliament. So if there were a political decision or instruction according to this thing, we are going to demand to know all those things. That's part of our responsibility. Our jurisdiction ends here in Parliament, and we are not subject to anything, including the executive. So we would want to have those things whenever we need them. And the minister can't withhold it, even if you consult, I think the highest authority level. The minister can't withhold anything from us. If we demand it, we want it. And if given, he knows, he should be knowing that he can't withhold any information. Or nobody can withhold any information from our side. The book committee has got legal authority, like the courts, we can demand certain documents to be presented. So if needs be, we can send a box to go and pick up someone, wherever. Because we'll also want to know as to how far they are, because some of these things have been said that they are. So we want to know who which was Alan over the house, Nilana, who are going to go make living, that's what I'm going to touch, you know, I will win. So we will go, we'll have to do another work. We may not end next week. We may not end next week. We may actually go beyond. But this matter and any other matter of this nature, it is something that we would like to deal with as a committee. And leave a legacy behind that we will not tolerate any kind of a thing of this nature. Baba Makonda?
Since we're going to deal with this matter next week, I want a confirmation from the DG, because we're supposed to have the report itself before the end of this week, so that over the weekend we sleep over it, so that on Tuesday we don't take time. We go straight to the matters and deal with these issues.
Tomorrow,
yes, thanks.
We'll end our meeting, and the meeting stands adjourned. Enjoy your lunch, enjoy your sitting of Parliament. Thank you.